This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Fame is not something a secret agent aspires to, unless you're this guy.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
Agent 007 is surely the most famous spy in the world. He has outlived many of the men who plotted to kill him and even survived the writer whose plots brought him to life. Since Ian Fleming's death in 1964, a number of writers have continued the Bond franchise. The latest is Jeffrey Deaver of Chapel Hill. He's written the newest Bond novel, Carte Blanche, which is due out here in the U.S. in June. Jeff's going to be at the Writers for Readers event in Chapel Hill Sunday and Monday, but he's here with us now. Jeffrey Deaver, welcome.
Frank, good to talk to you.
Tell us how you came to be heir to the Bond franchise.
Oh, sure. Can I go way, way back? No, I'm a writer, so I promise I won't digress because we're not supposed to.
As long as this doesn't start with the earth cooled, fine. Good.
Well, pretty close to that. I'll talk about my early years. I was about eight or nine when I read my first James Bond novel. I can't remember which it was, probably Dr. No or something like that. And I was a nerd when I was a boy. I didn't play sports much. The girls didn't pay any attention to me. And so I was drawn to reading and writing. And I loved heroes. And I just got very enamored of Bond and his suave sophistication and sense of daring do. Read all the books when they came out. And by the time I was, you know, in my mid-teens, I said, well, I want to do this. I want to write for a living, and I want to write this kind of story. Well, fast forward until a few years ago, and I had published a book of mine called Garden of Beasts. I think that the year was 2006 or so, and it was maybe my 10th or 13th book at that point. It won an award in Europe sponsored by the Ian Fleming Estate, basically best thriller of the year, and they provided a cash prize and a little Ian Fleming memento. And in my acceptance remarks, I said, well, this is such an honor to me because I feel that Ian Fleming not only was a part of my upbringing, but a part of my literary development. He taught me how to write a good, solid thriller. I didn't think anything more of it, and a couple of years ago, the estate contacted me and said, we were so moved by those words. We read all of your books, and would you be interested in writing the next one? And I debated 7-8 seconds and said, yes, I'm on board.
Yeah. Well, how do you approach writing a James Bond novel?
Sure. We set the rules right up front. And I've written roughly 30 novels now. I've been doing it full time for a number of years. I have a very specific type of book I write. And, you know, if your listeners are familiar with the Bone Collector, say, or my recent book, Edge, they take place over a very short time period. They move very quickly. I love my twists and turns. Every book of mine has three or four big surprise endings. Just when you think it's done, just when you think it's safe to go back in the water, no, it isn't. Something else comes out and bites you in the rear. So I said, I can't do anything but that. That's the kind of book my readers like. It's the kind of book I'm comfortable with. Ian Fleming's original Bond books were much more character-driven than that. Bond, characters like Goldfinger, Felix Leiter, the CIA agent, Miss Moneypenny, they were real to us. They came to life. But Fleming's plots were actually quite linear. He didn't do the twisty, turny, fast-paced stuff that I do. And they said, no, no, that's fine. You write your book. Just make sure that the Bond you bring into it is our Bond. And I said, well, that's fine. I'd love to do that. I do, however, want to update him. The book takes place in the present day, and Bond is a young 30-something-ish, we don't really mention his age, agent for the Secret Service, a recent veteran of the wars in Afghan and the Middle East. And I followed very closely, I think, the Fleming model for James Bond. Poor guy ends up in one of my books. He never gets a minute's rest.
Well, what is that? What is that model? How do you perceive who their James Bond is?
For the people who know Bond only through the movies, we see a suave, sophisticated character who's, for the time, somewhat hip, despite Lazenby's ruffles from the Edwardian look in the 1970s and Roger Moore's haircut. Since your listeners can't see me, I'm very jealous of Roger Moore's haircut, I will say. But those were products of Hollywood, of course, and the thriller movie establishment. Bond was larger than life and really could do no wrong. And I love the movies. I love Sean Connery. I love Daniel Craig very much. Mm. I think he's an excellent Bond. The Bond from the books was a very dark, gritty, nihilistic kind of person. Fleming himself called him a thug. He's a man who would do whatever it took to put his life on the line, to rescue the innocent, to do the heroic thing for queen and country, the cause of democracy. People don't understand that the 00 number did not mean that he was allowed to kill somebody if he were attacked. It meant he was an assassin, that he was told to go out and sneak up behind somebody and kill them. Now, he did that very, very rarely. And indeed, in some books, he never killed anyone at all. But he was prepared to do that. And one of the things I look at in Carte Blanche is the psychology of a person who, even if he does not do that, is prepared to. And it's a valid question that we have now when we look at the conflicts that our government and the democracies around the world are going through.
So it gets back into the, as you say, the psychology, the deeper, a kind of a deeper bond. The other, I think, distinction between the books and the movies would have to be the gadgets. Let's play a clip here when Bond meets Q and is introduced to a few of the things that might keep him alive.
One pane, unbreakable glass, one standard issue ring finger. Twist so, voila. Ultra high frequency single digit sonic agitator unit.
You know, you're cleverer than you look.
Still better than looking cleverer than you are. Follow me, please.
There we go. A little Oscar Wilde in every one of those films. are gadgets, is that going to be a big part of what you do?
Well, Frank, actually, this brings up a slightly broader point. I have had to be very cognizant of the responsibility in writing Carte Blanche. Again, I've written a lot of books. I know how to put a thriller together, so I wasn't worried about the plotting particularly. What I was worried about was making sure that the many fans that I have are happy and the many fans of the original Ian Fleming books are happy. And frankly, the fans of the movies are happy as well. I will digress briefly. My philosophy of writing is that we do this for the readers. Anytime an author comes into an interview like this and says, well, I write for myself. It's their job to understand me. You should say no. That's ridiculous. We authors are so lucky to be able to, first of all, get published. And in my case, it's so rare to make a living as a novelist that we have a great responsibility to make sure that the fans are satisfied at the end of the day. So yes, there are gadgets in the book, but I have taken the approach, as Ian Fleming did originally, that the gadgets that are introduced are fairly sparsely shown in the book. And I came up with another very interesting challenge. Nowadays, my cell phone does more than any of the communications gadgets that James Bond had in the 50s or 60s. How much more out there could there be? So yes, I have created a few fun things, which I'm not allowed to tell you about, or my cell phone will activate and drag me out of here. But I make sure that there is a lot of fun stuff in the book.
Do you in the films we've seen, there was a period at which they had to be self-referential. I mean, it got to the point where the 30% of the film was making references to other Bond films.
Sure.
Does the literature do that, and do you feel any compulsion or any weight of the history and legacy of Bond?
2 years ago, a wonderful British author, Sebastian Fox, wrote basically a sequel writing as Ian Fleming to Fleming's last book, The Man with the Golden Gun. Fox's book was set in, I think, 1968, a few years after Fleming died and after we last saw Bond created at the hand of Ian Fleming. And there were many references to the prior books, as there had to be, because it was really a continuation of the Fleming franchise. I didn't want to do that. I want to introduce a whole new legion of readers to Bond. So we did decide to set it in the present day. We have no references to prior characters or prior plots other than the characters that would logically appear in a reboot. And obviously, we're going to see M. We're going to see Moneypenny. I don't want to give away some of the other folks we're going to see, but of course, you're going to have to see that. But I really want to start out from scratch and let readers see him for who he is, kind of a Jack Bauer character with a British accent.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting to think about the trajectory of this character and its history, because even the geopolitical assumptions that you make, I mean, Bond comes of age in the Cold War, even though he was never directly involved with agents of either side, there was always a middleman. But still, that was the assumption. That was always in the background. What does that character look like today? What does espionage look like today? What are the assumptions you make as a writer?
I did a great deal of research, as I do with all my books. I like to get the facts absolutely accurate. And I also like to put in a bit of esoterica, not digressively, but I think readers enjoy learning things, even in fiction. And I spent time actually with folks I know at the CIA and American security agencies, with a few people in England, British security as well. And I was surprised. Actually, I have to say I was shocked at how little, aside from the technological aspect of it, espionage has changed over the years. And I'll give you one fast example of the research. Certainly, a lot of high-tech communications devices. Back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, spies would subtly communicate using this technique. They would lace their shoes slightly differently, and depending on what the bow looked like or the tie or which eyelet was used,
I love that,
that conveyed a communication stress.
Great.
That's still used today.
Wow.
Because nobody can monitor your shoelaces. They have to know what to look for. And I was astonished that the tradecraft is very much the same now as it was then. And I was so interested in it that I make tradecraft a theme throughout the book. We want to like Bond very much, and he's a likable, heroic character to start with, but I wanted to make him a master of his trade. And so we learn a lot of very, very clever things that he does, along with his associates. One does not spy alone, of course. And I became a walking encyclopedia of all kinds of great spy tricks. They're fairly useless on the idyllic streets of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, but at least I know them if I need to.
What about the bigger picture in terms of audience? Things have changed a lot. A spy, an assassin, essentially like James Bond, and his kind of madman approach to women coming out of the late 50s and early 60s may have been more suitable to the culture at the time, and a belief that your government will only do the right thing, even if it has to do something uncomfortable. There's a lot more skepticism today about the government, how it can act, and scruples. does that change how you approach this character?
Well, it does. The Bond of the 1950s and 60s was a product of his time. Life was much more black and white. They were state enemies, not non-state actors. He did have an attitude toward women, although I will say in the books, he actually had quite a heart, and he was continually looking for a partner. You know, he was married twice, actually, in this series, and he had at one point a girlfriend with whom he lived and was devastated when that didn't work out. There were certain elements that I suppose we would describe as a bit sexist, and of course that doesn't make any appearance in the books whatsoever. We have to like him. With regard to the conflicts, though, I was doing an interview in the Middle East just recently when I was over there promoting the book, and the interviewer had said, "Well, James Bond in the 1950s up against the Soviet bear, world domination. This is 60 years later. How can you possibly find enemies that equal that?" And I said, "Well, you know, the Soviet Union in September of 2001 did not attack the country. There are plenty of threats out there." And one of the major conflicts that Bond runs into not only is identifying the threats, a problem that we all have, finding them, but what kind of support does he indeed have from the government? And I love titles to do double duties. Carte Blanche in the book is a specific reference to a very technical aspect of espionage, but it also in a broader sense allowed me to ask the question, which is a theme running through the book, when one is given a carte blanche to defend his country, how far does he go? When does he have to start asking moral questions about what is too much? Because he can't phone home. He can't say to M, Is it okay if I do this or not? He has to make those decisions himself, which I think gives the new Bond a great deal of depth.
You are also involved in the fourth annual Writers for Readers event in Orange County, put on by the Orange County Literacy Council.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Sure. I do a lot of literacy benefits. It's I laugh sometimes. I have to say it's not for self-interest. It's not so I can encourage people to buy more of my books. It's that I was very, very fortunate to grow up in a household that encouraged reading. So at a fairly young age, I was reading books that, well, the Bond books, for instance, that were perhaps a bit beyond my years. But I do feel that it gave me a great sensibility. It gave me the skill to discern when I was looking at moral issues and coming down on the right side of them. It taught me reading books taught me how to relate to people. I read To Kill a Mockingbird not long after it was published. I was 12 or 13, I think. And what that book teaches about race relations, for instance, you could attend lectures for the rest of your life and never come away with the emotional aspect of it. So not to belabor it, literacy and reading are important. Reading can change our lives daily. And so around the world, I participate in events. And the Orange County Literary Council is doing a wonderful event this coming Monday. May I shamelessly mention the website?
Please, yeah.
Okay. If you want information on this, just go to orangeliteracy.org and you'll get all the details.
Jeffrey Deaver, thank you so much.
Frank, wonderful to be here.
Jeffrey Deaver is a Chapel Hill author whose novels include Edge, The Burning Wire, and the upcoming James Bond novel Carte Blanche. He's going to be at the Writers for Readers event in Chapel Hill this Sunday and Monday. For more information, orangeliteracy.org. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.